when technology hits the streets, it doesn't always get used the way that security people predict it will be.
Hello and welcome to Identity Today. We're taking the noise out of tech talk, bringing together the best minds in the business to chat all things identity, security, biometrics and more. I'm your host, Blair Crawford. Today in the show, I'm joined by Wolfgang Gorlick, advisory CISO and strategist at Cisco Secure. Today, we're talking about edge use cases and real-world security. I really hope you enjoy the chat.
I think it might be worthwhile to take 1 minute to discuss security.
Today in the show, I have Wolfgang Gorlick. Welcome. It's great to have you on today.
So great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So we're going to get into a chat about real world security, and we're going to learn a little bit about you in a quick fire round. So we've threw together a few questions, and within a few minutes, everybody's going to really get to know the real you. And then, of course, we'll get your professional introduction as well. So if you could please answer with the first things that come to your mind, these questions. What food from home do you miss the most when you're traveling?
Oh, Middle Eastern food, unless I'm in the Middle East. So falafel, hummus, it is fantastic in Michigan due to, you know, being close to Dearborn. Anywhere else in the country, really anywhere else in the world, I don't think they understand what hummus is supposed to be.
We got pretty good hummus in Sydney. So the next time you come over, have you been to Sydney before? Have you been to Australia?
I have not. No, that's one part of the world I've yet to get to. So, you know, full disclaimer, Sydney is not included in what I just said.
All right. Next question. Where do you get your security news from?
From people asking me if I read this article. In the old days, I would keep up on all these RSS feeds and on everything. And I did the math one time, and I realized that one day's worth of news was taking me about 5 days to read, and I would never catch up.
100%.
And so now it's calls like this or conversations where people are like, oh, did you see the latest article on? And that's where I get my news.
I have I use Feedly. To get my RSS.
I do too, yeah.
And it's fantastic. But if you make a mistake, and the mistake I'm going to refer to is you follow the wrong feed, you will literally just get hundreds of security breach alerts. And that can happen easier than you think. So yes, I agree. It can be overwhelming. So I get a lot of my news from just conversations like this as well. All right, what's your guilty pleasure? And you've already said hummus is a big favorite of yours, so it can't be a guilty pleasure in hummus.
Singing. And do not ask me to sing. I'm a terrible person to sing. I love singing, though. So I oftentimes, as I'm wandering through the house, which is much better working from home, very awkward in an office, I'll be just humming along whatever song stuck in my head and making up lyrics as I go.
And does that relate to the next question? From all your singing and your favorite bands, have you also been able to come up with a spy name for yourself? And if you have, what would it be?
Oh, so I'm lame here, like Gorlick, Wolf Gorlick, right? So like the Bond, James Bond thing. One of the things that I think people my age would get, but the younger generation doesn't, is it really was like very bold thing to do in the 90s to go by your name as your hacker name. And early on, I'm like, no, I'm not going to make up like Nikon 57. I'm going to go by my name. And so I think that would be my spy name.
Fantastic.
I always admire James Bond for doing it.
Have you seen the new one?
No, not yet. Is it good?
Yeah, it's very good. It is. I wasn't sure whether we're going to go with it in those middle ones with Daniel Craig, but the end, the last one in his series, very good. I enjoyed it. All right, last one before we get into it. If you were a wrestler, and in fact, I don't know that you're not a wrestler, so that might come out here. What would your entrance song be?
A cover of I'm a Bad Guy by Billie Eilish. So I heard a very good cover of this, and it was like this metal singer, and he had the whole growl going on and everything. That's what I would want. I love that beat.
All right, let's see if we can make that happen at some stage for you. and afterwards we'll have hummus and dip.
Fantastic, but only in Sydney or Dearborn or in the Middle East.
Fantastic, sounds like a plan. All right, so now that that's done, let's hear a bit about your professional background. Could you tell everybody who you are and what you do, and then we'll get stuck into this?
Yeah, these days I'm an advisory CISO with Cisco. I focus in on the Cisco SaaS products, so Duo Security, Umbrella, Kenna, those sort of tools. I have a background in financial services and healthcare, where I led IT and IT security for a hospital system and a money management firm, respectively. A lot of IAM work, especially in the money management firm. Coming out of that, I did consulting for 5-6 years, where I ran 4 different practices and launched an academy. But one of those practices was our IAM division, where we focused heavily on SailPoint for IGA and CyberArk for PAM.
A big focus for this today is talking about real-world security. And to me, and when we were doing a lot of our preparation, we're talking about security as it translates into the field. How does it actually go down from a practical sense if something is to happen? But through your career, you must have seen hundreds of vulnerabilities and then practically how they've been exposed. So can you talk a little bit about the challenges that you've faced through your career and what you've seen in security?
Well, so much of it sounds so great on paper. I'm going to do RBAC. I'm going to define a role. I'm going to assign some rights. People will flow into that role and they'll flow out and everything will be great. But of course, the minute you start to get that even close, the business announces a merger or we're restructuring this division or these things have changed. So certainly a lot of problems there. Single sign-on and multi-factor, right? Thou shalt do multi-factor. Okay, that sounds great. And then you realize only a certain number of your apps will support it. Thou do SSO and you realize that, oh, we're not licensed for the SSO edition of those applications. So much of what I've learned about security over the years, and we're actually coming out with a new field guide through Cisco that talks about this, because we looked at zero trust, you know, ancillary to our conversation today. But one of the things that bubbled up out of that was everyone who has a mature version of zero trust says that they also have a couple other things. They've got great relationships with their execs. They got great relationships with their peers, and they've got a good security culture. And I think that's kind of a cheat. I think if you have any of those things, all of a sudden everything becomes easier. And so much of my career has been coming to grips with the fact that security is not solved with a technical solution. It's solved with trust, a good relationship, and a good understanding of how tech rolls out when it's touched and, you know, manipulated and used and consumed by people on the field.
Just touching on that point you made there around SSO, you know, the license I have doesn't have SSO. This irks me because from my perspective, having SSO or some, I would say, fundamental security as a fundamental security function if your applications support it. But the price point at which SSO is made available often touches on the enterprise licensing agreement, which a lot of SMEs can't afford, nor do they need to be able to pay that much for the feature and function they need in their business. So I suppose my question is, do you think something like SSO and baseline security requirements should be available in the base licensing, or do you think they should be available only at those higher premiums that seem to be offered across the board?
So I think that it should absolutely be available in all product licenses. Wendy Nather, who I work with, is very fond of talking about the security poverty line, which is this line beneath which organizations don't have the resources because they can't afford the licensing, they can't get the good people. And those are the organizations that have gotten hit again and again and again by ransomware. And those are also the organizations, when you look at supply chain breaches, right? Like the very famous one with SolarWinds, it didn't start with a, you know, Fortune 100 company. It started with one of these smaller companies and was rolled into. So I do think, I understand the need for tiering, right? SaaS applications need to make money. There needs to be tiers, but there should be a baseline of security and functionality across all products. I recently did a webinar with a PAM vendor who rolled in their MFA, and I was so happy to see it. It made me so pleased to see that now is available in their lowest tiers. And I want to see more organizations do that.
Yeah, I think it's important. I remember even an example from us when we were a very young business. We had, there was about 10 of us and there was a CRM. So obviously the clients that we work with as a security vendor, there is a baseline of security requirement in order for us to be able to interact with them. And we were paying, say, I don't know, a few $1,000s a year, which is a subscription license for the CRM. It was a premium CRM, so it had a whole lot of feature and function. But SSO was not available in it as an example, and nor were a list of other examples, another list of feature and function. And we tried to negotiate, and the price they came back was $26,000 to uplift, because we had to, in inverted commas, take the enterprise version. That poverty line is definitely something which is an exploit vector, which has to be removed from the smaller businesses. And we eventually, to be fair to them, they moved, but we caused a lot of noise in order for them to do that. I don't know if companies which are not necessarily security small businesses would have put the pressure on that business the way that we did, and thus have just said, oh, well, cool, when we get bigger, we'll get SSO plus all these security things. That's an interesting point, the security poverty line. And I think that's something that we probably need to help organizations navigate if they can't afford the security tools which they need to protect their businesses in this current environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, to your point, you're not only a security company, but you're an educated consumer. Assuming you've got buy-in from the top since of how your organization is structured. Imagine if you're, a company in the medical field, right? Where really all you're concerned about is delivering a very specific products. Your CEO is not going to push for that. He's going to go, okay, well, I know that you say we need it, but we really don't, because they're not offering. If they did offer it, maybe then it'll be important. It really is intriguing to me, this conflation of security with enterprise licenses. Yeah.
Do you, talking about that example there where you've got a particular industry where the CEO might not see the immediate requirement to uplift security and, let's just say, spend the big bucks to protect the asset. Often when we're in conversations, there's a fine line between, you know, practically explaining why something's needed and sounding alarmist or sensationalist. And the example I'll use, it was in healthcare, which is why you reminded me of it there. There was this problem with a healthcare provider in Australia, and the problem which was being investigated, which it was being coined as data voyeurism. So basically what they had was an issue where the information, medical information, which was available in the asset, basically people with weak credentials, shared credentials, were just looking at what was wrong with people, just because it was kind of a weird reality entertainment thing. But saying that out loud right now, it can sound quite alarmist or quite sensationalist. You've got this group of people who for some reason are just looking at what's wrong with all the people who are in wards, for example. So how do you, from your experience, navigate that? Do you even agree with that? Navigate that line between sensationalist, alarmist, practical use cases? What do you see?
I think a part of it is making a story relevant. I think a lot of what security people have to do is we have to make what's interesting relevant and what's relevant interesting. Yep. And sometimes that can be the same thing. Like we are concerned about people viewing data, and therefore we've got a lot of demands for better data privacy. Other times that can be completely at odds. I remember when there was a identity provider who got breached early on in 2022. And there was a lot of conversation around, well, maybe we need zero trust. Maybe we need to do this. Maybe we need to improve our identity, our supply chain. What do we do about contractors? And some of my peers, CISOs that I coach and CISOs I talk to, were like, oh, yeah, they came to me. My executive team came to me, and I set them straight. You're like, we're not even using that vendor. And even if we were, there was only three people who were affected. And I was like, why did you do that? If they were interested in it, why didn't you tie it to things that were relevant to you? Like, oh, that's really interesting. We're not directly impacted, but that could play out this way. So I do think there is a need for security people to really listen to what is interesting our executive team and turn it into what's relevant in our organizations, especially around identity and those protections. Related to that, there was analysis done of risk management many, many years ago, where they found that the speaker postulated that risk was a function of not only vulnerability, but also of outrage. So things that seem very personal, things like you can view my grandmother's data and see what's wrong with her, Things that seem very personal oftentimes spark that outrage. And it may not be the real vulnerability. It may not be the thing that they really should be caring about in their life. But it is something we need to be very conscientious of, is ensuring that in doing security, we're thinking about the perception and how that story can be told.
It's a great point around the relevance. And I think defining that relevance within the context of what, you know, how a person perceives a problem or what actually matters to them. I think we're seeing a lot in security, and we talked about this with one of the other guests. People are ordering zero trust, almost like they're at McDonald's or something. It's like, get one zero trust and, you know, a side of fries, please. It doesn't work like that.
No, it doesn't. That's where it goes back to, you know, having a good story and a informed story. That goes to threat modeling, possibly to doing a tabletop so we can get everyone on the same page. It's interesting with any one of these security controls, whatever the trendy control is of the day, that's the one everyone talks about, not realizing all the different vectors and what that will cover. And that's invariably where security leaders end up answering 2 years later. Well, why are you asking for this? I thought you solved all this when you bought, zero trust with a, you know, large fry. I thought we were all set. Why are you coming back to me for another meal? We have to be very careful with those stories and really tie them down into true threat vectors and true threat models.
So you spoke at RSA previously about transforming security by design, but one of the things you discussed was the result not necessarily being defensible when you implement security by design. Can you unpack that a little bit? What were you talking about there? And what were the salient points of your, your argument?
Yeah, so my argument is effectively there's five abilities that security teams need to master. And oftentimes we only focus in on the defensibility, right? I'm going to put a control in place and that's it. Once I have zero trust or multi-factor, whatever it is, I'm done. I can go home. But there's also usability. How widely is this going to be adopted? How accepted is it going to be in the culture? There's also, you know, auditability and manageability and marketability. There's five abilities that I really focus in on. But the main two, to answer your question, is usability and defensibility. And for years, we've looked at security as, well, these two things are in conflict. Clearly, they're in conflict because every time I put a control in place, it makes it harder to use. And therefore, there's this, but not really. I think when we think they are in conflict, it's often because we're not using the right lens. Most of what an adversary will do is a pretty well-known path, right? We can, again, threat model that. We can use frameworks like the, you know, MITRE ATT&CK framework. We can pull out tactics and we can map all that out. And we throw controls on this path willy-nilly. And where we fall into trouble is by not looking at the path the user takes. What is the user journey? What are they doing to onboard and offboard users? If we're thinking about it from an IAM perspective, if we're thinking about it from a PAM perspective, what are they doing to check out credentials? And what does that process look like? And if you map both of those paths, what happens is we oftentimes find a number of tactics that adversaries use that we can put controls for that are completely invisible to the user because it's not on that path. It doesn't affect them. Or conversely, we can find ways that, oh, if the user is doing this, we know that's probably the user, not a criminal, and we can use that as a signal. One of the things that I love to see in PAM programs, for example, is to say, okay, rather than allow 6 billion devices on the planet to contact my PAM console, I'm going to limit to the one or two devices that I know this user has. And even if you got the right creds, even if you have, you know, done a multi-factor challenge, if you're not on that approved authorized device, boom, you're done. You're not getting in. And that really radically reduces your attack surface. And it's invisible to the user, you know, your day-to-day sysadmin who's doing their job because that's the machine they use.
That's coming up a lot in our conversations, that example you've had around device binding and to an extent application binding. So we're reset with the biometric identity as we bind the biometric identity, which has been created off the back of a passport piece of information, then to the authentication application itself. But then that application is bound to the device, which is approved to be performing in an authentication workflow. one of the, and then of course that gets better and better if you start to deploy MDM and so on and so forth. So that's starting, we're starting to see that trend, if I can call it that, being asked for. And it seems like such an easy thing and a logical thing to do when you think about it. Make sure that 6 billion devices can't initiate in a workflow, for example, only locked down to the ones that the user is meant to have.
Yeah, I think the biometrics side is really fascinating. And some of this is being driven, of course, around the FIDO Alliance and what they've done with the WebAuthn and the CTAP standards, and this idea of having a direct binding. But other things, you know, we've done for quite a while with doing, you know, privileged access workstations or secure access workstations, doing device-level authentication. There's a lot of really fascinating things that can come out of that. Now, I think it's important to state that this doesn't solve all security problems. Any of us who's been in this field knows the minute you put in place a barrier and that barrier gets adopted widely enough, the criminals get incentivized to work around it. We're seeing that already with MFA. So there's some things that could happen with that, right? We know that criminals may shift how they phish, for example. We're starting to see phishing that does not steal a credential. Why? Because of everything you just mentioned around, you know, passwordless authentication. Instead, it tries to trick the user into an OAuth flow and authorizing the adversary application. So things like that we're going to see. I can imagine we'll start to see more criminals using malware, like, you know, the scam that we used to all hear about from our uncles and our grandparents. Oh, Microsoft called me and Bill Gates said he needed it on my computer. And now my bank is weird, right? Those sort of like installed software and those types of threat vectors where we just have the adversary waiting, you know, for someone to log in is going to be an issue. And also too, people are people. I know a number of people who share their password with their spouses or their kids, or in biometrics, I've seen people go, oh, I can enroll 5 different fingerprints. Okay. So 1 is me, 2 is me, 3 is my wife, 4 is one of the kids, and 5 is the other kid, right? So we know there's going to be ways. Again, when technology hits the streets, it doesn't always get used the way that security people predict it will be.
That one with the biometrics, and I mean, I'm trying not to bias this. Obviously, I'm highly biased towards that type of biometric because the device-based biometric suffers from those problems where you can roll multiple people and you don't necessarily know who you're authenticating in the flow because it's ultimately the device which is being authenticated. This became really real for a customer of ours when they went, do we do FIDO-based biometrics or device-based authentication, or do we want to look at a capability, i.e. like ours, where we're identifying the user on the way in? And the reason that it came to light and why they made the decision one way or another was that an engineer in one of the calls said, I have enrolled my partner on the biometric because we share, it's a BYOD, so we share our, and the red flags, the red flags just all went up around the room. And this is just, people don't think about that, especially in BYOD. Who are you authenticating, the device or the user? So what are you seeing out in the field about this conversation? Because we're kind of maybe replacing one problem with another.
Oh, I'm sure we're trading problems, but it's one of the, I'll give you 2 ways to think about this. First is the counter to that is, yeah, but how many of us, when we're just relying on a PIN code for our phones, have shared that with our partners?
100%.
So is it really increasing our risk, that the partner risk? Probably not too much. Is it reducing significant risk from a defensible perspective of criminal activity? Yeah, significantly. So one way to think about it is from that lens. But another way to think about it is, and I suspect this is where passwordless is going to go, and I know this is your domain, so you argue with me, but another way to think about it is, rather than just viewing that biometric as, you know, you're authenticated, you're in, having additional checks, right? So the application of ML to see what applications that they're running, when and where, the use of perhaps an additional check-in before you get to something sensitive, step up authentication before you're, you know, taking an action. I think if we, again, think of that entire flow of where users are going to perform the job duty, there's a lot of additional things that we can put in place that don't necessarily impede them, but reduce that that risk. So I do think it's a concern. I think it's a valid concern, but I do think that we're trading off a lower risk for answering a higher risk. And I also think that the overall work that's being done around trust and authentication authorization will mitigate a lot of these things.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think there's no silver bullet in any security control. As we've already discussed in this, you have to have multiple layers. One of the ways we think about it is if you can get your authentication and prove who the identity of a person is on the way into a session, then that's one part of it. And it allows you to then focus resources and spend on more sophisticated or higher risk problems throughout your workflow, which have been more difficult to solve. And then, of course, looking at how you use, from our perspective, if we are using the biometric on the way into the session, how do you then enable that to be called at any point as a person steps up? So, for example, for our high security clients, before someone moves from classification of document X to a higher classification, we re-inject a liveness detection check or a behavioral biometric to make sure the person in the session is still the same person. But that should, of course, be wrapped around all the other context-based information, which should be part of the authorization flow. You know, are they on a VPN? Is this an approved device? Where in the world are they? You know, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah.
No, I really like that. And I think that is what is opening up for us, which is ratcheting up or even ratcheting down the security, depending on what the action is. I was working with an insurance company, and in the United States, there's this requirement that before you view any prospectus or anything, you need to authenticate. However, they were running into a hurdle insofar as everyone they're trying to get to view their prospectus didn't want to sign up for an account and register. So they actually enabled social logins, which meets the spirit of the control, to see a lot of that information. Now, what's the worst that can happen? Someone, you know, used your LinkedIn inappropriately and viewed a prospectus. Oh, no. And as they got people more engaged, then they had a sign up and a standard authentication. And then when you got to making trades and doing those sort of things, that's where you had the step up and more of the view around behavior. And I really think that's going to be the future, is injecting those controls and interrupting that workflow only when it makes the most sense, and really getting out of the way, which is not something security people have done for three decades, but now we've got some opportunity to do so.
Security controls can't get in the way of people doing their jobs. And I think that's one of the main umbrella design features or principles that has to be deployed, because humans, we're funny, we'll try and circumvent stuff, which annoys us, and we want to avoid that. So just getting on to the current cyber threat environment, we're now seeing a lot of conversation from a cyber physical. People are not just saying cyber, they're not just saying physical, they're saying cyber physical threat environment. How are you seeing that evolve from your perspective as a security expert? And I think one of the things that I'll add to that is that the physical perimeter obviously used to be the offices, but now the physical perimeter is like the whole world. You can work from anywhere. So are things changing in terms of a CISO's mindset to consider cyber physical threats as opposed to just cyber threats?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's similar to the conversation we just had in terms of ratcheting up or ratcheting down. Where is the person? What's going on? You know, it's funny. It reminds me many, many years ago, my data center, when I was in financial services, switched to biometrics. And when they put the sensor in, it went in like in the summer and it worked great. We headed towards Halloween. It was still working fine. By the time we got into winter, it wasn't working. And as you might imagine, what had happened was our fingerprints were dried out and the sensor wasn't working. So we brought the guy in and I yelled at him, you know, we need to get in the data center. We need to do our jobs. And so he fixed it. But the way he had fixed it was adjusting the crossover error rate.
Oh, yeah.
And so for the next few weeks, I was logging in with it. You remember the old gummy bear trick where you could put your fingerprint on the gummy bear?
Yeah.
I'd log in with the gummy bear and hold it up to the camera. and I finally made my point. But since that time, you know, the sensors we're all carrying around with us in our phones or FIDO keys or anything have greatly increased.
Yeah.
Greatly increased. And the privacy and the fact that it's in one device has greatly increased. So what's been interesting to me is using those mechanisms, and I'd love to hear from you if you're seeing more and more of this, but using those mechanisms to say, okay, I am going to use a biometric to unlock a door. That's the same, you know, biometric that I'm using to log into my apps or everywhere else. So it's a consistent user experience. It's a high quality signal. And then I can also pair that with, what does the GPS say about where the phone is and additional factors?
Yeah, I mean, from our perspective, our idea was to have one biometric digital identity available for any authentication workflow. So our customers will use iris, face, or finger to get into physical locations, but that same biometric can then be used to access Microsoft, into Okta, ForgeRock, Auth0 environments. It doesn't really matter. So you have that consistent identity piece. But I think also what we're seeing, which has nothing to do with the authentication capability, but it's about behaviors. We had a fantastic person on, Athene Dennis, who's a social engineer, and we were talking about the vulnerabilities around red teaming and physical threats. So she won the black badge at DEFCON a number of years ago. She's a social engineer, and she said it's sometimes so easy as turning up to a physical location, high-vis vest, couple of coffees in the hand. Oh, can someone get that door for me? It's all over.
And you're in.
It's unbelievable how much that happens, especially from my perspective and what we're seeing in the field, especially problematic in places like critical national infrastructure providers because they have so much OT legacy tech issues. So if you do get past that physical perimeter for, say, you know, you're socially engineered or whatever, red teamed, once you're in there, the damage that can be done from a digital perspective is just, it's outrageous. So what are you, I mean, you, this social engineering piece and the red teaming, what are your thoughts on all of that? What are you seeing?
Well, I can tell you, I am by no means ready for a DEFCON black badge. That is incredibly impressive. So kudos to them. When I was doing consulting, I would oftentimes try to see how far I could get into a space. And this one time I was helping a hospital get ready for a HIPAA audit. And I walked in the front desk. I'm like, here's who I'm meeting. Can you help me out? And I got to the elevator and I went down and I had another locked door and I was trying to figure out that. And I waited I was rattling it and the nurse comes in. She's like, can I help you? Anyways, I went through the whole process all the way up to the data center where I flagged down a janitor and said, oh, I'm here to meet the CISO. He wants me in the data center room. He's like, oh, they never tell me anything. Let me let you in. And so I ended up being in the middle of the data center room and called the CISO and said, hey, do you want to meet here first? And he's just like, we got a lot of things to fix, don't we? I'm like, yes, yes, we do. Let's get started. So yeah. And so just imagine what I could have done with a high-vis uniform on.
And a couple of coffees. So actually, in many ways, don't like this question, but we always ask it when we get someone who represents the kind of overarching security posture of an organization. And the question is, what would your advice be for a CISO trying to improve their overall security posture? And I don't really like it in many ways because it's hard to find one thing, but I always ask it because you never know what gem they're going to come up with. And we're going to, you know, we'll collate all of these gems and then we'll have a plan.
I will be listening to that episode where you have a plan. Here's what I think. And the data seems to be bearing this out in the Cisco security outcome study that I mentioned earlier. What is the secret to identity access and management? If you look at all IAM programs, what is the secret of the ones that succeed and fail? It's relationship management. I had a good relationship with the people that had to do things. What is the secret to good asset management? Relationship management. I had a good relationship with the IT team. They gave me the resources. Vulnerability and patch management. Relationship management, right? DevOps, the SEC and DevSecOps. Relationship management. I had great relationships with the SRE team, the dev team. When we've looked at the data, the folks who report great business continuity disaster recovery, the folks that report great incident response, the folks that report great zero trust, all of them have fantastic relationships with their executives and their peers. I think all too often, security people like myself came from wiring up data centers, came from configuring servers, came from probably using gummy bear skin in data centers in places they shouldn't. But we start with like, all right, here's the tech and it's going to solve everything. Where at the end of the day, the main underlying driver is, have I built good relationships before I launch the security programs?
Would you have a beer with that person test? That's what it comes down
to. Yes, I like that.
That's a good one. That's going to find its way into the plan, I'm sure.
Great.
Focus on relationships. Don't let gummy bears undo your security posture. Fantastic to have you on the show today. Before we wrap up, can you let everybody know what you're up to at the moment outside of what you discussed here and where they can find you, projects you're working on, etc.?
Sure. Yeah, I'm doing a lot with identity access management and zero trust. You can find that on Duo's website as well as Cisco's website. I blog a lot about security design and risk management. You can find that at jdubgorlick.com or follow me on Twitter at jdubgorlick. And most recently, I started a podcast with my wife. My wife is a sex therapist and relationship therapist and an author. So we've been doing the series Securing Sexuality, which is all looking at modern relationships on all this technology. Again, enrolling your spouse on your phone, what happens when a variety of different things don't go the way we expect. So that's at securingsexuality.com, and it's also available off of Apple Podcasts.
Fantastic. I am sure we will have you back on the podcast again if you are happy to return and get into some of the things we discussed in more detail, perhaps. But in the meantime, we'll speak to you soon.
Thank you so much.
That's all we have time for this week in Identity Today with me, Blair Crawford. I'd like to say a big thank you to our guest, Wolf, as well as a big thank you to you, our listeners. If you want to know more about what we do at Daltrey, head to daltrey.com.